So, hey everybody, it's been a long and cold and lonely winter on the Fun Drive. We missed you, but I want to say that we were active in the Fun Drive. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. I really want to thank our Voices listeners. You guys really, really did great. So, we're back. I'm with a guest today, Antonio Gonzalez. He's the director of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, also the Willie Velasquez Institute. We've known each other for a long time. He's doing some interesting work around trying to do voter registration in the Southwest, obviously around some theory of Chicano power. He has very good ties to people in the Third World, in particular in Central America. He's got a lot of thoughts. I think I don't know where we're going to start the conversation or end the conversation, but we're going to have a good time. So, Antonio, very happy to have you on the show. Antonio Gonzalez, as I introduced you before, a longtime veteran. Let's go right away to Venezuela. I was very deeply moved by, I thought I was for the revolution until Jared Leto said that we should all go and support everybody in Venezuela who's fighting against the dictatorship. What dictatorship? What's happening in Venezuela? Is there a popular government?
Well, there is a popular government that has been repeatedly voted for in what are widely considered to be among the best electoral processes in the world, repeatedly for 15 years now. But there is also a very challenging economic situation there, and a very active counter-revolutionary movement. Unlike the previous socialist experiments, in which from the Soviet case all the way up to the Central American revolutions, the counter-revolution was neither eliminated nor expelled from the country. So the pink revolutions in Latin America, which I would argue are the most advanced revolutionary situations we have in the world today, have included the counter-revolution in society. There are not massive refugee exoduses, nor massive executions or eliminations or anything like that, even though there are in place sort of semi-revolutionary constitutions, semi-revolutionary governments. So that means that you have a situation of pretty constant polarization, revolutionary mobilization, and counter-revolutionary mobilization across society. And Venezuela has certainly had that. And right now, there is sort of like a middle-class rebellion fomented by the opposition that has won the international media war for the moment. Won this several rounds in which they've been able to posture themselves as some kind of popular majoritarian opposition, like some would say like the Ukraine. But it's not close to that. There is a massive support for the Bolivarian process, that's how they call it. These protest activities have been only carried out in about 5% of Venezuela's cities, but they're projected across the world as, you know, a massive majoritarian rebellion against the Bolivarian government. Far from being true. But you know, it is polarized. There are clashes. Venezuela is a highly armed society,
right,
and people have been killed on both sides, just like after the elections, which were just held, and the opposition rejected the results even though they lost by 10% and burned down 20 party headquarters of the government, and 10 people were killed, and so on and so forth. So Venezuela is in a polarized scenario based on real problems, but the revolution has not eroded at any qualitative level.
Well, I was just talking to a friend of ours at the Labor Community Strategy Center, Sun Young Yang, who is a Korean woman who was in Venezuela right now as part of a Korean delegation to Venezuela. She speaks both Spanish and Korean and English. She came back and said, I just talked to her last night, that it's not remotely an equal struggle, that the masses did come out in very large numbers, that it's reasonably calm, that the right wing tried to foment as if it was a mass movement, couldn't get a mass movement off the ground with all the banging of the pots and the CIA, and that the specific forms of popular mobilization that Chavez had left in place and encouraged went to the streets, took over the streets, and this is her vision that I'm going to ask you. Her assessment, having been there, is that the West is trying to project it like it's 50-50. But her argument is Maduro came out really well on this, that the right is split, that the right has in some ways been discredited, and that the U.S. is even on the defensive. Now, that's just one perspective. How do you see it?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to what she's saying. The Maduro government has held out a fig leaf, reconciliation and peace negotiations. A national dialogue has begun. Elements of the right have boycotted it. There's a backdrop to this. The electoral opposition came close to victory at the end of last year and in the middle of last year, but lost. Their leader is a guy named Enrique Capriles Radonsky. He's a right-wing figure, but sort of not center-right, but in Venezuela, he's center-right. And the hard right, the violent right, the coup, the golpista, coupist right, hates his guts. And many people say these mobilizations and the violent turn they took were really engineered by the golpista right run by a guy named Leopoldo López, who was very much a leader of the 2002 coup that momentarily overthrew Chavez and the revolution, and has been a figure in Venezuelan politics and wants to be the head of the opposition, because the electoral strategies to overthrow the revolution have failed and there's not another opportunity for an election that could displace Maduro or a referendum for a couple of years. And in that strategic vacuum, they radicalize these marches, these protests. And there's reasons to protest in Venezuela. There's inflation and shortages. There is a capitalist private sector offensive against the government, hoarding. Because they have price controls, they're hoarding goods and exporting them to Colombia and hoarding them in warehouses. And people don't have access to goods in a lot of places, basic goods. And so that's a real problem. There's a lot of violence. So there's real protests, but they got radicalized into a pushist, coupist tenor recently. And that's this fight within the right to make it into another coup.
The voice you're listening to is Antonio Gonzalez. He runs his own show on KPFK called Strategy Session, right?
Right. And Mondays at 4.
Mondays at 4. So you got to listen to that as well as listen to us Tuesdays at 4. And we want, if you like what he has to say or find him interesting, which I do, you should check him out. Now, let me go through a few other thoughts that I had. So let me ask you this. One of the things I think a lot of our listeners don't understand is that when capitalism comes to power, like Pinochet, he's not under any obligation to achieve a socialist set of objectives. I mean, he's under the obligation. He can kill anybody he wants. He can torture anybody he wants. If there's poverty, the military just says, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, rise up or be killed. He can throw the state wealth into the hands of the capitalists. He can engage in foreign negotiations that are not even in the best interest of Chile, but will still bring profit to Chile. Sun Young was saying that the Venezuelan bourgeoisie before Chavez was one of the worst bourgeoisies, that they never did anything for the people. So now you come in. Here's the point. You come in. You're in the middle of a world capitalist system in crisis. You're an oil exporting nation. You have massive poverty, no infrastructure, no educational, you know, very little capital. And yeah, there's going to be a lot of problems, my point. You've inherited and crime and a lot of people that are disenfranchised from the so-called traditional economic system. My perception is under that. They've done a pretty good job of, one, trying to solve at least some problems, because that's one thing, to give people something to say, it's not the same. I'm asking if that's true. And secondly, to provide some ideological frame. And third, to build relationships with other nations. Why don't you take one at a time and see if you think, take me on. So the first being that they've actually done something qualitatively better that people can point to. Is that true or false?
It's absolutely true. When you look at the Bolivarian movement, they're fascinating because they are very praxis-oriented. They sort of come from a Marxist tradition, but there's a lot of traditions in there. Nationalist traditions, Christian, sort of Christian, radicalized Christian traditions. And they had some very interesting people, including Chavez, but in addition to Chavez, this guy named General Mueller, who discarded the Leninist theory, vanguardism theory. He said, well, it's been superseded by history, and our theory is, in Spanish, it's called Partido de Avanzada, which means in English the sort of advance party.
And he thought of it very much in military terms, but to me, it really describes how the Venezuelan leadership has moved in their 15 years in power. They don't presume to have the answer. They presume to find the answer. So they're always probing, like an advanced group does militarily. They send, they try this, they try that, they try this, and then they come back, whether it's in the economic area or with the masses or in international, and then they come back and go, okay, this didn't work, this did, let's do this, strengthen this, broaden this, deepen this. And that's very much how they've governed. They make all kinds of mistakes. I've always been impressed by their ability to learn from their mistakes.
Tell us, our listeners, one thing that you would say that the average Venezuelan can say, whatever the socialist government has done, it's done this for me.
There's more than one. There's health care, there's poverty reduction, real transfer of wealth. In terms of, you know, everybody, every housewife in Venezuela gets like a social security pension.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
Wow, that's right.
Subsidized basic food basket, which is a common socialist theory, theme.
That's right.
Education, a dramatic expansion of access to higher education, dramatic, like 100 new community college campuses across the country. Land reform, title, urban title, you know, people just lived. You grabbed a place and you didn't have any title to it, but that's where you live. So they've titled all that. Massive expansion of voting. I mean, this is one of Chavez's great contributions is socialism and electoral democracy are not contradictions.
That's right.
And they had, you know, when Chavez won, there were maybe 8 million voters. He got maybe 5 million. And now there's almost 20 million voters. Amnesty. In 2004, the Chavistas realized they had the same percentage of undocumented workers in Venezuela that we have in the United States. They had a meeting. They said, okay, well, let's legalize them. They went to Congress with a bill, legalized them, and within 6 months, they had legalized 2 million Ecuadorian and Colombian persons, and that was in 2004 and 5, and by 2006, they were voting in the presidential and national elections.
Just take a minute there, Antonio. It's very funny because, you know...
It's not that hard, really.
No, that's right. That's what I'm getting to. You know, Obama's going, well, you don't understand. You don't know the conditions, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah.
And the Cubans came in, and in 1 year, 850,000 young people went to the countryside and educated 2 million campesinos to read, right?
Right.
The Chinese came in and got rid of foot binding and opium in 1 year.
Right.
So revolutions do things,
yeah.
Right?
It's not right.
It's not that hard if you really want to do it.
It's the opposite. We have a saying, you know, friends of mine that work in the Cuba normalization movement, and their saying is, no es fácil. It's not easy. That's a very American saying because it's not.
Right.
It's not that hard if you have a revolutionary government and a mass movement.
Right.
And that's the so there's 50 things that you can say in Venezuela if you're in the 60%. And I always tell people Venezuela is a 60-40 country.
Right.
Okay, about 60% are like there on the election day and for the programs, and about 40% are against. And you know, that's it hasn't changed that much. A lot of people were surprised that the Maduro government won almost 60% of the vote in the municipal elections just a couple of months ago because they thought, well, now that Chavez is gone, it's going to be 60-40 the other way. Since Chavez is worth 20%.
That's right. That's
charismatic,
right.
And he was a great charismatic figure. And
by the way,
tomorrow is the year anniversary of his untimely passing. A great loss to the social justice movements in the world. And I think we should take a minute for Chavez tomorrow.
I think that's really important, and let's do that. I mean, I was just thinking about everything in my mind is an article because I'm a writer. So I was thinking of We Can't Catch a Break, the death of Hugo Chavez, Choke Lumumba, you know, that we have to throw out charismatic leaders. It's essential. The system doesn't need charismatic leaders as much. It rules through force. These people are interchangeable with this Hillary and this and that. But you don't get too many Cesar Chavez or Hugo Chavez. You don't get Martin Luther King. You don't get Dolores Huerta. You don't get Fannie Lou Hamer. And as we lose one, these are major. So the role that Hugo Chavez could have played, I went back and read his thing about Bush being the devil. But I didn't realize that he went back and did this whole analysis of imperialism. He didn't just throw it out of nowhere. It was funny. It was brilliantly organized. And what a loss, huh?
Well, this is the big moment. In a way, this Venezuela events are a big test of the new leadership. Chavez left us too soon, but he did do a lot to put things in place so that the movement can continue. It was inconceivable to think of a Bolivarian you know, sort of alliance of Latin American countries that neutralized the neoliberal scheme of the United States. I mean, who could imagine that in 20 years ago?
That's right.
When that was the heyday of neoliberalism and, you know, the some of the Americas and, you know, from Patagonia to Alaska and all this, you know, the giant free trade area of the Americas was the Washington consensus. And Chavez created an alliance in Latin America that destroyed it. The Washington consensus is gone. And Latin America is, I think, the sort of the leading edge of social change in the world today. And Chavez put that in place. It was, you know, his Bolivarian regional vision of unity of Latin America around a social change agenda. And he financed it. He organized it. They've created institutions, banks, funds. And those plans continue. And yeah, he left us too soon, but he left a lot in place that I think peoples and movements and progressive governments can work with.
The voice you're listening to is Antonio Gonzalez. He's with the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the Willy Velasquez Institute. What's interesting about this whole conversation, this is Eric Mann, by the way, you're on Voices from the Frontlines. If you're interested in getting involved in this conversation, 818-985-5735. If you actually think about this and have something to say, we'd love to hear from you. So here's a couple of thoughts. Is it true that obviously, you know, when you first come, I'm talking about Maduro now. So he comes to power, and obviously he's perceived to be not the anti, but the non-Chavez. So he has to find his own identity.
And hard act to follow.
Hard act to follow, right? So he wins, and they say, well, look, you see, that was all the Chavez legacy. Without Chavez, look how close the election was. But here's my premise, my hopeful premise, that he came to maturity in the battle against the right, and that he is now beginning to create his own legacy in the middle of a civil war that didn't turn out to be a civil war, in the middle of U.S. clear intervention, CIA and CNN mass distortion. The right couldn't get its act together, and I'm asking, are there more people in Venezuela beginning to say, I get it, Maduro is not the non-Chavez, he's the Maduro?
Not yet.
Okay, good. No, tell me right.
Not yet. I think Maduro has to now solve the problems. I mean, Venezuela is an organized place, and the you know, they have mass movement and revolutionary structures and organizations and so forth, so they can withstand these middle class protests.
Right.
Okay, but how do you address the issues that are below that protest? Because there's a lot of griping in Venezuela. You know, a lot of people don't. Housing is a big crisis. There's a shortage of millions of homes. And he's got to address that. And local crime is a big problem, right? That's a policing issue. And
that's,
I remember
right,
having this conversation with, you know, comrades in Venezuela. I've been there many, many times. And hearing them talk out loud about, you know, this is – we didn't know what to do with policing because our whole experience in the revolution, we were against the police.
Right.
So we didn't want to be the guys that were like imposing police in our own barrios around crime when we were victims of police brutality before. And they didn't know how to grapple with it. And it bit them in the ass. And now they have to grapple with it. So they've trained a national police force, you know, because you got to address the issues of quality police. Like we know here, you don't want to not have police, but you don't want to have corrupt police or abusive police either. And they've had to deal with it. And so Maduro has to solve the socioeconomic problems. He's got a big problem with his, you know, the capitalist intervention in the economy and grain shortages.
I want to stay back to the police because I think what you're right about is this is Eric Mann talking to Antonio Gonzalez, and I think you can see on Voices from the Frontlines, this is like the two of us just talking to each other and you're listening. One of the things that I think is very difficult about socialist construction is you inherit a government and an economy that cannot feed all the people. You have massive groups of people that are in the so-called secondary or underground economy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't provide for them through just social services. And the next thing you know, pretty organized forces get involved, gangs and gangsters.
Yeah.
And say, look, to the 20% of people that are totally excluded from the economy.
Yeah, they fill the void.
They fill the void. So now you have a problem where you're a socialist government, but this is not simply random poverty stealing. You know what I mean? This is a whole nother counter structure. And what do you do that is different from U.S. imperialism? And what is so-called progressive nonetheless? It's a form of, it requires some level of suppression, right?
Yeah, sure.
So what's the conversation like? Not the solution, but as you were saying, take us back inside again. The people in Venezuela talking this out loud.
Well, they didn't have the answers, but they knew that if they didn't address it, they would lose political capital.
That's right.
Because, you know, I've had people in work in Venezuela. We're taking groups down there, and we have Venezuelans working for us, and they're getting robbed. Right. They're getting robbed on the street, or, you know, like smash and grab. You know, somebody steals their cell phone or that kind of thing, and it's overlaid with political violence. Right, like people getting whacked because they're with the Chavez by right-wing gangs, just like out there in the street.
Right.
I had a consultant who was down there, and that her son, who's a big Bolivarian, was at a car stop, and somebody walks up to him and shoots him in the head through his car window, and it bounced off. It bounced off. He's alive to this day, but he was known as a youth leader, Bolivarian youth leader,
right.
And his enemies, you know. So there is. It's not a civil war, but. You know, there's a class struggle going on.
That's right.
And it has an electoral expression, and it also has a sort of a social violence expression. And that's sort of an argument to have a more robust police force, Bolivarian police force, that can buffer this and take it out of random and not so random social violence. And that's what they're grappling with. They've already built a national police force. Is it activated yet? Sort of. Perhaps an even bigger problem is the shortages. That's a big deal. Inflation is not such a big deal in Venezuela because people's wages are indexed.
Right.
They have subsidized food, and gas is 10 cents a gallon.
Wow.
Now in the climate change movement, we'd like frown on that, but they don't frown on it there.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And Chinese motorcycles, you know, you pay $100, you get a motorcycle. It's like there are subsidies for the poor and for the working class that mitigate against inflation. Inflation hurts the affluent. So my ties down there go, we can handle that. But shortages, we have to deal with that.
You're listening to Antonio Gonzalez, and we're having, I think, a pretty interesting conversation about the reality of socialism. When I was a kid, the first book I read on socialism was Looking Backward. You know, it was a utopian socialist
right.
book. And it was very simple. They say, well, how did you deal with everything? He says, well, we just shared everything. And he says, well, didn't the rich get mad? No, they came to feel like this was just wonderful. So they realized this was in their interest too. Well, how did you deal with this? Well, we just did this and we shared that. And I went, this is fantastic. You know, socialism sounds so great. And now, for those of us, people are talking about so-called 21st century socialism, which I want to get to, is I want to make the case that it's very tied to 20th century socialism and 19th century socialism. It has to be on this continuum. But when we take the break, I want to get out of Venezuela as a nation state and into Venezuela as an organized counterinsurgency against the United States in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
So in this context, you know, when I was growing up, 1960, 61, started getting involved in the civil rights movement. Of course, there was the Cuban Revolution, the Bay of Pigs, and the Organization of American States. And it almost seemed normal, like it did for a minute, like, of course, the United States was part of the Organization of American States, which denied Cuba. And, of course, it didn't take me long, once I joined the movement, to realize, oh, my God, this is U.S. imperialism. This is the Organization of U.S. Imperialist States. But the difficulty of developing a counter-hegemonic organized force, whether it's politically or economically, to have any sense of a common market as opposed to a free trade agreement. Why don't you tell us, here's a couple of questions I have. Tell us briefly, how did ALBA and the other structures that Chavez tried to organize, and then walk us through some of the other states, in particular Brazil, and what's going on between Venezuela. So start with, what was Chavez's vision of developing the beginning of essentially an indigenous common market in Latin America?
Chavez, from the beginning, if you look at his the works on his thought, developed the Bolivarian concept, in which he sees Latin America as a future federation or future nation. And that's very different from how basically everybody but the Cubans had talked for some time. He developed this vision by looking inward not at Outside Models, although he was, you know, he was a secret member of the Causa R when he was in the military. But he was studying.
What was the Causa R?
The Causa R, sort of a proto-Trotskyist group, initially a split from the Communist Party in the 60s. They parted with Chavez in the 92 coup. They were this civilian sort of armed group that tried to overthrow the government. The 92 coup of Chavez is the response to the massacre in the 1980s called the Caracazo, right, which we're also celebrating, by the way, the 25th anniversary of just last week, which really marks the beginning of the Venezuelan Revolution as a fact. You know, the decision was made to take power through the Caracazo in 1989, ironically the same year that the socialist world began to collapse.
That's right.
One of history's great ironies.
That's right.
Well, it's collapsing everywhere. The seed is blossoming in Venezuela, which was, again, one of the history's great ironies, the American countermodel to the Cuban Revolution.
Right.
History's better than fiction, right? Truth is better than fiction. So Chavez proceeds systematically. It's in his discourse that, you know, first, you know, we're gonna reorganize Venezuela in the interests of the poor, and then Latin America. And he systematically did things. For example, he was elected in 98, took office in 99, and that's when Argentina collapses. And Argentina collapsed due to their debt to the World Monetary Fund. Well, Venezuela paid their debt. Several billion dollars, a lot of money in Latin America, paid off their debt and freed them from the IMF.
Wow.
And there's all kinds of things like that where he's developing, as soon as they had somebody to partner with, because he was alone for a while. He was alone for 4 years until 2002, where Lula wins in Brazil, and then they win in Argentina, and then four, they win in Ecuador, and then six, they win in Nicaragua. And he was sort of like, well, I'll carry the ball until you all can join me. But remember, in 2002, he's overthrown.
That's right.
And in 2003, the oil companies, which had been sold off by the Venezuelan state into the private sector, they sort of tried to bring it back, which they did, but there was a national oil strike. And then there was a national referendum in 2004. So there's 3 years of stone counter-revolution going on in Venezuela that they survive. And while that's happening, they're simultaneously helping others win elections, creating the ALBA Alliance, the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas, leading and creating the Union del Sur, the Union of South America, and then ultimately, several years later, creating in essence, what is an OAS without the United States of Canada, the Union of Latin American and Caribbean States, which was just created maybe 3 years ago, which includes Cuba, by the way.
That's right.
It includes Cuba. And, you know, pronouncing dead the Washington Consensus, that's at least 10 years ago they pronounced it dead. And it's pretty amazing. You know, they used to make fun of Chavez because he would drink 16 cups of coffee a day. And it's true. The man didn't sleep. It ran his aides ragged. So they had a very busy agenda, and they've created these structures, now trading with each other, intensely trading with each other. And they didn't used to do that before. Funny story, they won in Paraguay. Must have been 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Was that with the priest?
The priest, Fernando Lugo. Well, like Honduras, you don't win in a linear line, win, 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 win. You win, you lose, you win, you lose. You know, it's like jagged. It's nonlinear. So around the same time the Honduran government is overthrown by a coup, maybe a year later the Paraguayan government is overthrown by a coup. And they created this common market of South America earlier. It was just sort of a capitalist creation between Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, Chile. But as they moved left, the common market moved left. So when Paraguay gets overthrown, Venezuela had applied for admission, was blocked by, I think, Chile. Blocked by Chile. So when Paraguay gets overthrown, their vote doesn't count. So there's like a 2 week interim where they can win against Chile without Paraguay. And so that's how Venezuela slips into the South American common market. So these guys.
Wait, just let me say something on that. You know, there's a lot of us, but in particular, I think Manuel Criollo and I do a lot of strategy and tactics. And, you know, you have these little windows sometimes.
Yeah.
I have two different theories. You know, one theory is when you don't know what to do, just run full speed ahead at the wall with your head. And 2/3 of the time, you'll get a concussion. And 1/3, there's a loose brick. and the wall opens up, and
right.
you didn't know it, right?
Right.
So that's one theory. But the other is when the second exists, when that little momentary second exists, you have to have all your allies lined up. You have to be ready to move. And I think Chavez's ability to vision it, to envision multiple scenarios, chess games, chess moves, 60, 70, 80 moves ahead from his enemies, is just what a phenomenal strategist and tactician he was.
Well, the evidence would argue that that's correct. I would just say that this teoría avanzada has a lot to do with it as well. This, you know, probe out there and then learn the lessons and then
that's
make
right.
a decision.
That's right.
Which, for example, Chavez, when he came into power, the first thing he says, we're going to fix this constitution. And when he takes his oath of office, he swears allegiance to the Constitution. He doesn't. He says, I swear that I'm going to change this moribund, capitalistic, anti-people Constitution. That's my pledge to you. And they do that by popular vote within a year.
Right.
That's why Chavez is reelected president like a year after he's elected president for a second time under the new Constitution. But he did not understand, but he learned. He did not understand the strength of the counter-revolution. He thought, I won.
Right.
He won big.
Right.
He even had capitalists with him, right? He even had
yep.
the famous Nelson Cisneros, the Venezuelan multi-billionaire who owns part of Univision, was a Chavista, and to this day is as an alliance of sorts with the government, more a neutrality agreement with the government. So he, you know, you crack off elements of the enemy and ally with them, as did Lenin, by the way.
Of course, as did Lenin.
But he did not radicalize the Venezuelan process until the coup and the oil strike and the referendum. This is where the famous missions come in, where they are mobilizing for health care with Cuban doctors, mobilizing for literacy, mobilizing for adult education, creating a new union movement. People don't realize, but throughout the Latin American process, for the most part, unions have not been with the revolution.
That's right.
They had to create a new unions. The existing mass-based unions were pretty much tied to the oligarchy. And that's a whole other discussion, probably with the exception of Brazil, but in Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, they were on the wrong side of history.
The voice you're listening to is Antonio Gonzalez, who can, if we had 7 hours, we would still be here, moving from piece to piece. I want to talk back to the issue of his vision of the Americas and help me understand the united front between Colombia, Brazil, and Cuba, and Venezuela. Explain those contradictions. How do they work together? It seems like Lula and his have opened up some room for Cuba. On the other hand, Lula has much more of a free market approach. How are they negotiating these relationships?
Well, you can put Latin America in sort of four boxes. Cuba's alone in the, you know, sort of old school model of, you know, you seize power, destroy the state, and create society anew.
Right.
Okay. Then there's the Bolivarian model, which is you seize power through elections, you keep the election stuff going on, you change the constitution with popular support, and then you use that popular mandate to recreate society.
Right.
With constant, you know, this constant back and forth. The counter-revolution is there, and it's within the country. Inclusion is your model.
That's right.
All right? Then there's the Brazilian sort of, and with Venezuela is like Bolivia, Ecuador, and to some extent Nicaragua. And then you have the sort of social democratic model, which is Brazil, which is you use the mechanisms, you take power through elections, mobilize the poor, but you leave the constitution alone and you seek to grow the economy. You're a better capitalist than the capitalists.
That's
growing
right.
the economy and using that bigger pie to redistribute wealth at some level. But you have an accommodation with the existing state and the existing capitalist class, like European social democracy.
That's right.
That's Brazil. Argentina is sort of between, they're Brazil, but they ally with the Bolivarians for regional reasons, right? They never want to be, you know, Argentina and Brazil are always sort of tit for tatting each other. It's a king of the hill between Argentina and Brazil.
And so let me ask you this question. In that.
Well, then the final class,
okay,
the final box is the U.S.
Right.
It's the U.S. It's
very important.
It's Colombia. It's Mexico.
Right.
It's the Pacific. It's fascinating. It's the Pacific versus the Atlantic.
Hmm.
Who understands it? I don't.
Wow. Well, this is great. This is Eric Mann, the host of Voices from the Front Lines. You're on 90.7 FM KPFK, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web. www.voicesfromfrontlines is our website, and www.kpfk.org is the streaming live on the web. So here's a question I have for you, that when Lula came in, Brazil sort of became capitalism on steroids. He brought in some really brilliant kind of market-based people. It wasn't a neoliberalism per se, but
no.
it was still a very aggressive capitalist growth theory. Did not do well with indigenous development, did not do well with environment, but yet, I'm asking, seemed to be trying to be a buffer with Obama to protect Venezuela, is that true? Seemed to be opening some space for Cuba and would defend Cuba and the United Front.
Remember this role was played two generations ago for three generations by Mexico.
Right.
Which was sort of, you know, authoritarian, capitalist, weird social democratic nationalist model, all kinds of contradictions internally, but growth, and then, you know, sort of FU United States, stay out of Latin America. Brazil wants to play that role. And I think there's a consensus across every group that I mentioned to leave Cuba alone. Cuba's sort of integrated with everyone else in Latin America. And so that's sort of respect Latin America. You'll hear that whether it's Colombia or Argentina or Mexico or Brazil. And Brazil is the one country that they perceive themselves as being able to go toe-to-toe with the United States, and the United States has to take that into account because their economy's become so big
that's
now.
Right, that's right, and they have so many foreign investors.
And so space for Cuba, I think, is a consensus issue in Latin America. There's different models. Venezuela and Colombia is fascinating because, they're opposed models, but they're like brothers. I mean, there's so many Venezuelan, Colombian mixed families, and they have so much trade ties and migration ties, and Colombians work in Venezuela. Venezuela's right. Got the employment generating economy. And with the exception of, when Colombia was run by neo-fascists,
right.
Their capitalist government and capitalist parties and politicians are like, we don't really need trouble with Venezuela. Our economies are intertwined. And by the way, Chavez, despite the accusations and media hype, has from the beginning tried to help end the Colombian conflict as a, honest broker, intermediary, trusted, and as have the Cubans. And they've been successful at some level where no one else was to help, bring in the FARC, as FARC,
right.
and others. At least to the negotiating tables. There is a Latin American ethos at play, no matter what group you're in, that was different before because you had these, military fascist dictatorships that were aligned to the United States, and it was a different deal. Colombia is aware there is a left in Colombia. They have the ability to win elections if the governing parties play their cards wrong. So I think all those factors have created a cohabitation sort of understanding within Latin America for the time being. If the administration becomes more aggressive with its Pacific Alliance plans, that creates a schism, and we'll see.
Jim from East LA, welcome to Voices from the Front Lines.
Hello.
Jim?
Yes, I have a question. Would Antonio develop a little bit on Causa Eire, its history and its development? Because it's something I've only seen. I think Richard Gott touched on it. I think I heard Peter Cameo talk about it once. But I really don't know a whole lot more about it than I know there was a formation within the military that threw off a lot of the old verbiage. And as Antonio talked about, praxis was what they did, not imaginary program. Would you just develop something about it for me to help me understand a little bit more?
And in 2 minutes, Antonio, because I want to make sure we get to the others.
The Causa Eire was a sort of a left split from the Communist Party in the 70s, I believe. And they sort of competed with the Communist Party for work both inside the military and outside. And became a pretty important political party that ran and won positions in Congress and ran candidates for president. They say that Chavez was a secret member of the Causa Eire when he was a colonel or major in the army. General Mueller, Hubert Mueller, the famous Venezuelan sort of theoretician, was a titular sort of the head. They say he was the one guy that could tell Chavez no. He just passed away, by the way. Mm. After the coup in 92, when the Venezuelans take 3 years to organize a coup after the Caracaso massacre in 1989, that fails. The Causa R were the civilian component of that coup. Everybody goes to jail. There's a fallout, and it splits into two factions: the PPT, Partido Patria para Todos Party, and the MAS, Movimiento al Socialismo. PPT becomes part of Chavez coalition. They're all over the government now. Now they're part of the socialist Venezuelan party, and the MAS actually moves into the opposition.
But I think what you're getting at is that the socialist roots of the Chavez, it's not simply that it was in the military. Thanks, Jim. Jeff from Lake Arrowhead, can we get you, Jeff?
Yeah.
Tell us, with Antonio, any questions you have?
Well, I just want to make a comment about the reality of the money.
Okay.
That was coming out of Venezuela on the oil revenue, because when I was in college, I had two brothers were attending the college. They were from Norway. And they used to hold a Thursday dinner and invite 20, 30 people with their guests downtown Philadelphia at a piano bar and then host them. They were probably 19 years old, two twins. And I had no idea that Venezuela at that time, this was in the 60s, even had oil. But they extended, the money went all the way from Norway. I mean, these people were from Norway, and they had a lot of control of the oil there. So I'm just commenting about whether people think that this is not true, that people are, taking the wealth out of the country. That's just an example.
Well, thank you very much. And now there's piano bars in Caracas where the people are having a much better time. Kevin in L.A., how you doing? And thank you for calling.
Thank you. I had a question about the statement that the inflation was only affecting the upper class. I wondered could you explain that a little bit further? Because I always thought that would have more effect on the lower class people, in the sense that they don't have the ability to react to it. So I'm going to take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Venezuela has a lot of programs that aren't infected by inflation. You have fuel subsidies, you have rapid public transportation subsidies, you have food subsidies, you have subsidies for housework that are indexed. And so if inflation rises, your subsidy rises. And education, very inexpensive. So there's just, when you have that kind of safety net,
right,
and social wage.
I was just going to say social wage.
Social wage, you're, much more insulated from this massive inflation than if you're sort of in the capitalist cash economy, which the more affluent are. Not that it doesn't need to be fixed, but it's just not, we can't imagine that in the United States because we're all on our own. But you're not on your own in Venezuela, if you're part of, and these programs are massive and broad and deep, and they affect, help tens of millions of Venezuelans.
That's terrific. Henry from Los Alamitos, how you doing? You're the last caller.
Are you ready?
Yes, we're ready, and thank you so much.
Thank you. There are huge quantities of oil in Venezuela. I have a two-part question. Does any of that oil go to the United States for processing in the Gulf? And two, is there any connection between the XL pipeline coming from Canada? Is this a way of squeezing out Venezuela?
Good question. Good question. Really good question. Venezuela sells a lot of oil to the United States. You have, the dilemma for both countries. In the United States, America says, well, we don't want to import any more quote-unquote foreign oil. And that's the whole shale oil. That's what it's about. That's the strategy behind it. Let's not bring any Arab or Venezuelan oil in here anymore. Good luck. But also there's a debate in not only Venezuela, but in all of the Bolivarian revolution countries, which is, should we go it alone without the United States and just make our ties to China and within ourselves and other countries that we have more, you know, friendly and respectful relationships with, or should we be engaged with the United States? And that question hasn't been really resolved. It's not only an economic question, but it's a political question, and it remains to be seen. So not only does the United States, the establishment, seek less oil from Venezuela, but the Venezuelans seek to sell less oil to the United States, but it's a very high percent of their oil does go to the United States, although probably less than before. The Chinese are very engaged there, and they're doing a lot more within Latin America.
That was Antonio Gonzalez. Terrific conversation. I mean, one thing I'm getting out of today's show is that mainly that there's a fluid situation in Latin America, but it's fluid in the direction of the left. And it's fluid in the direction of reduced influence of the United States, never getting rid of the United States, but some pretty encouraging stuff. Thank you so much, Antonio. I learned a lot, as always. So, hey, folks, we love Voices from the Front Lines. We love you all, really. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines. We'll see you next Tuesday at 4. And thanks so much for being with us.